there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco. We are continuing to comment on the Chronicles of Narnia. This episode, we will be doing the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which, for our purposes, for Thinking Fellows purposes, may be the more challenging one yet of the ones we've done, but I think we will see.
It'll tax our abilities as literary analysts.
Rather than theologians, yes. The Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of our shows there. This is our first episode of 2022, and as such, if you're new to the podcast network, you're new to 1517 or the Thinking Fellows, you may go check out the rest of the catalog of shows. There's quite a diverse platform there. Everything from commentary, like the Thinking Fellows, where we do, you know, Christian history, apologetics, literary analysis now, I suppose, and Christian doctrine, to commentary on the Old and New Testament, with 30 minutes in the New Testament and 40 minutes in the Old Testament. In fact, we may have listeners trickling in who have discovered those through their appearance on the Bible app now.
Oh, nice.
As well. So, welcome if that is how you have found the Thinking Fellows or anything else at 1517. Okay, guys, so the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. For our purposes, I'm just reminding people this is book three, though I believe in the book set, which is a newer one that I have, it was labeled book five. So the order is quite different in these, but because they move around the Horse and His Boy and the Silver Chair, and the Magician's Nephew. So things are shuffled a bit. But for us, this
was... So it starts with Magician's Nephew, goes into the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Then it's Horse and His Boy.
And that makes sense.
Yeah, and then it's Prince Caspian, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Silver Chair, Last Battle.
Yeah. Okay, didn't we talk about this a while ago, how the original order was just sort of the order in which Lewis wrote them, and then I guess his publisher asked if had thought about reordering them, and he recommended the order you just spoke of, starting with Magician's Nephew, because it kind of follows a chronology.
Yeah, it does. It's internally the chronology is right, because Horse and His Boy, well, Magician's Nephew is the creation story, then mm-hmm. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is the first with the Pevensey children. But then the Horse and His Boy is set while they are still in Narnia before they go back through the wardrobe. So that does make sense.
I get the chronology. I think, jumping into Dawn Treader, it actually is a little unfortunate because you can tell he comes into explaining why things are sort of puzzle piece ordered around, at the very beginning of Dawn Treader. He does an analysis of the time hopping that happens, because when they meet Caspian this time, it's only 4 years later, even though a year or more has passed in Earth's time.
Yeah.
Whereas when a year had passed between them being in Narnia during The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then coming back during the time of Prince Caspian, thousands of years have passed. So he does this trick where he talks about where in the first two books, it's mostly like a linear change, that time is accelerated in Narnia. By this time, it's what you were talking about, which was it becomes more simply described as different.
Yeah.
When and where they get dragged in is different.
Yeah. So the funny thing is that Voyage of the Dawn Treader is 4 years after Prince Caspian. The Silver Chair is still during Caspian's time, but it's 70 years after the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Caspian's an old man, and it's about essentially rescuing his son. But there's a reference in the Silver Chair. At one point, a blind bard comes into the court to tell a story after the older Caspian has set sail, and they go back with Trumpkin. Anyway, blind bard comes in to tell a story, and the narrator says, and the story he tells is the age-old story of the horse and his boy. But I shan't have time to tell you this now, so I'll save it for another time. So there's a reference in Silver Chair to what is the next book in the original chronology, which is The Horse and His Boy. So that's interesting. I kind of like that, because it's almost like the Silmarillion with Tolkien. It's an untold tale.
That he plans on telling.
In the silver chair that has obviously happened 1,000 years in the past, during the reign of the great high king Peter, that is now of legend by the time of Caspian's reign, and is being told along with the other great tales of the reign of Peter, the great high king.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that he seems to be developing what he's going to write, but he's not quite sure, and he gives hints. And maybe some of that's just him having fun, but even in the text of this, he'll mention a story here or there, and he goes, I don't know all the details about this story, but if I hear it, I might write it in a book.
Right.
And so you get the idea that he's now come to the conclusion that there are going to be lots of books in this series. He doesn't know how many. And as ideas come to him, starting off of little tiny points in other stories, he will write. And that seems interesting. It seems that even by this point, he has not come to a sevenfold conclusion with books that all make sense with each other towards a end. It's definitely not a, it's not like an epic like that where it's one story from start to finish. They are individual stories.
Yeah, and like we've said before, there's a difference between the storyteller, Lewis, sort of writing these in an internal, consistent chronological order, and the evangelist, Lewis, telling these in a way to get across an apologetic slash evangelistic Christian message, which is, I think, was at least the point of the first several books.
Yeah. Well, Adam, this was a seafaring story, and I hear, although I have not seen, that you're quite the seafaring fellow yourself, or was.
Well, I'm not anymore because I don't live near the sea, but yeah.
It's a
long ago, I spent many moons, many years on the sea, sometimes on top of the sea, sometimes underneath the sea in a steel tube made of HY80 steel that flexed at certain depth. Sometimes I was in a scuba suit in the middle of the dark ocean.
I'm impressed that you know what kind of steel submarines were made of.
Well, it's just one of those things that sticks out in my head because I remember when you'd go and the line you're supposed to say is greater than 400 feet. Beneath the surface, the torpedo men, we're getting way off course here, but what the heck, would stick a line from bulkhead from wall to wall, and it would be tight. And as the submarine would go deeper and deeper, the line would droop. And they'd always talk about HY80 steel is meant to flex, but still be very strong.
They're like, don't freak out. It's meant to do this. That's why I remember that. Like,
and I even have a chunk.
Be okay.
I have a chunk of HY80 steel somewhere here in my office. It's about an inch thick. It's from the hull of a submarine that was decommissioned. So anyway, we should probably get back on track.
Well, it is incredible to think about an inch thick plate of steel flexing. Like how much force you have to...
It's incredible and terrifying. I think it was the USS Scorpion, was it? That they have a video or audio of it diving, and then all of a sudden you hear kind of like a can being crushed. Oh. And that's it. Wow. So,
jeez.
Yeah.
No, I think some of this is appropriate, though, to draw on Adam's sailory experiences. Because there are
seamanship.
There are a lot of nautical terms in this. In fact, Lewis points out that you're not going to be able to get through the book unless you know the difference between port and starboard.
But then he hardly uses them. I thought it was kind of funny.
Which one is port?
Well, and some of them I had to actually look up, like the little boat. I forget what it's called that Reepa Cheap gets on and.
Oh yeah,
it's like a kayak.
Yeah, well, it's a tiny little tiny thing. Anyway, yeah, those nautical terms, port and starboard.
Which way is port? Port, Adam.
Port is on your left side. Starboard is on your right. And in my head, I've got some cadences going on.
How do you remember it?
Same number of letters in port and left.
That's kind of an odd way to do that, but yeah, okay. I like it. That's fine.
Yeah, and running lights, which they wouldn't have had in Narnia, red on the left or the port side and green on the starboard. So you can tell at night which way a boat is going by
they mentioned things like the poop.
A lot.
The poop deck, yeah.
He's up on the poop. I'm like, I don't know what the poop is. What's the poop?
It's the higher deck.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's short for poop deck. And I forget why they call it the poop deck. I don't know if it has anything to do with poop or not.
Yeah. It has to. What'd you think?
I don't think so. Don't.
Well, because the poop deck's typically in the rear, the aft part of the ship, and so maybe you hang over and...
Yeah, that's where you poop.
Yeah. Interesting. That would be...
We could probably Google it, but...
Yeah, we could.
All right, well, that's enough of that.
Yeah. The only... one of the reasons I bring it up is I like the nautical adventure book. I am known to enjoy... only a handful, but... I have read and reread and very much enjoyed both the Odyssey and Moby Dick, which
That Moby Dick one, that's a real that's saying something.
I there are parts of that book which are painful to get through. I think even people who enjoy it get there, but I enjoy that book, and when they hit some rough seas, I was like having some vague Moby Dick PTSD. I was like, when is the whale going to smash him on the rocks? You know, or when every good sea story has running out of water. Like, this is always a problem, right? And and this happens.
And
even
supplies,
here.
Right? In
and
general.
Supplies in general. Yeah. Very, very clever of Lewis that when rough seas happen, it's the water casks, not the wine casks that break. Right, like that. Every good seafaring story, you're gonna have people, try to commit mutiny over the lack of water. That becomes very important.
All right, so what's going on in Don Treader?
Well, I want to say from a theological perspective, when we read Prince Caspian, you and I had this like aha moment, and it was like, this is obviously the theological theme. This one is very apologetic. It's against modernist, worldview. There was not a clear one to me for the majority of this book. I kept trying to work something as I was reading with Eustace, but it just seemed like the lesson really was don't be an ass, as far as Eustace was
so
concerned.
I've been thinking about this, and so I think we should, for people that haven't read it, you should introduce that basically Caspian the Tenth, who's the main character in Prince Caspian, has been king for a while. Things are going much better in Narnia. If people remember from reading Prince Caspian, they hadn't really been a seafaring people since the time of Peter. But now Caspian is trying to get them back into seafaring. And so they're on this boat, the Don Treader, which Lewis mentions several times is a fine boat, but is much smaller than the great galleons of Peter's time.
Right.
So it's a boat, like maybe a ship, not quite a ship. I don't know the difference. What's the difference, Adam? Size, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So it's not a big galleon. There's not a lot of people on this. So sometimes when they get on an island where there's
30 of them is what it says.
I think they said there are 35.
Yeah. They lose a man or two.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of them on this. If people can recall back to Prince Caspian, Caspian's uncle had sent his father's, Caspian the Ninth's, 7 best friends out to be seafarers because he knew, since they had not been seafarers for so long, that the 7 best friends
wouldn't return.
And that's how Miraz grabbed power, mm-hmm. basically, from Caspian the Ninth, who was then killed, and then Miraz, am I saying that right, was sort of the regent. Mm-hmm. Sort of the ruler in place of Caspian the Tenth. And so what's happening now is Caspian is going off to find these 7 lords to see if any of them survived and where they are. And they end up, long story short, they end up going to basically the edge of the world.
Well, and that's actually part of a different promise, though, because they have discovered all 7 lords. So
at
the beginning it mentions that the trip is twofold. To go discover all 7 lords and to go find the end of the world, so to speak, for Reepicheep, who has...
And they end up going as far as they can.
Yes.
Yeah. Side note, I thought you'd love this. They discover that their world is flat, since you're kind of a flat earther.
I'm not a flat earther.
You really appreciate that.
I am not a flat earther. Where did you get that idea?
I mean, you've made some arguments to me before.
I've said that it is... some of the arguments that I've seen are scary, but they're frightening. But until you realize things like aerial views and satellites, which you know, as somebody who doesn't neither flies a plane nor controls satellites, you do have to have a bit of faith in.
So, like I said, I thought you'd appreciate it since you're kind of a flat earther.
Oh my gosh!
And what do you think about the moon landing? Just kidding. Don't get into that.
I think it was a military exercise.
Oh boy. Okay. So that's sort of the you know, condensed version. Now the children come into it from Earth, but if people remember back to Prince Caspian, Peter and Susan are not allowed to come back to Narnia.
They do a very pragmatic job of explaining that away, though. This time they don't actually explain the age thing that we've mentioned before until the very end of the book. At the beginning of the book, the reason why is because Peter is busy studying for exams, and he lives with the
great Nock / Professor Kirk.
Yeah, he lives with Professor Kirk,
who's had to move out of the large house.
He became poor
because something happened, and now lives in a small cottage.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they would have all gone to stay with Professor Kirk.
So he, and then Susan is on a trip to America
with their parents because their father is lecturing abroad.
Yes.
Yes. Very Oxfordian. Father is a lecturer. Peter is with Professor Kirk.
And let me just also, I got to confess a little bit here. I know you probably see me as a Philistine. When I read the book again, after you reminded me via text the other day, I realized, because I've got the image in my head, I've seen the movie several times. I read the books years and years ago, have seen the movies several times with my kids. And reading through the book, I get the images in my head from the movie. But then as I'm now sitting here thinking about the timeline or the story, I have to figure out which one am I thinking about, the book or the movie? Because there are, it's not hugely significant, but significant differences between the book and the movie. Because the movie talks about, or has Peter and Susan both in America, and so on and so forth. So as you're doing this, wait a minute, which, are we talking about the same book?
I didn't remember that about the movie, but I think you're right. What I remember about the movie is how negative it is towards Susan when they sort of, when Lucy, so the scene is completely different, but when Lucy goes into the magician's house and she sees herself as beautiful, she first sees Susan in America, and Susan is at this like cocktail party flirting with 15 boys at one time type thing.
With a bunch of army guys, Marines or
and
something.
So, which that's not in the book. Right. But so the other thing I was going to say is funny. So the children that are in this story are going to be Lucy and Edmund, right? We know those two. And then one that we don't know yet until this book, which is Eustace Scrub, who is their cousin.
Yeah.
And Lucy and Edmund, because there's not room at Professor Kirk's house, had to go stay with their aunt and uncle, and they're staying in the horrible town of
Cambridge. I thought that was pretty funny.
They were staying down in Cambridge.
Which the education that Eustace is getting in that horrible town of Cambridge is progressive.
Yes,
and is horrible.
I did notice that was the feature, right? The feature was that it's progressive. And he makes some notes about things that would still be considered pretty oddly progressive today, which was like Eustace's family is very intentionally and notably vegetarian, all of them.
They don't drink or smoke.
They don't drink or smoke, so they're health conscious.
They wear special underwear.
Yes. Now, I'm...
Caleb, actually, I think that's an important point just for clarification. By progressive, we're not just talking about their looking to advance themselves or something like that, but they're progressivists
and very
modernists. And Eustace is a total know-it-all. Can I say prick?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could say prig.
Wow.
Prig.
Which would be fitting.
they're progressivists. So this is again a little off topic, but moving to Chicago area, when people ask me how I think of Chicago, I always say, well, moving from California is a liberal, but at least Californians are more hippie, laid back type liberals. out here, they're mean. They're know-it-all. And that's sort of, that's Eustace. He's like this mean-spirited know-it-all prig.
Yeah.
Who's going to tell you what is the case.
Right. And he's read all the wrong books.
That's, yes, said over and over again.
Yes. So he's read books, and what you find out is that he's read STEM books.
He likes, well, no, and textbooks especially is what they
say. He has. He's read science.
Technology, math. Engineering.
And math. But he's not read any sort of classical literature, any, classic fiction stories. He's not read any books that would be useful to him in Narnia.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
For the first three quarters of the book, all he wants is there to be no adventure at all, right? He wants adventure to end. And his solution to all the adventurous parts of the story are modernist inventions, submarines, and he wants a smooth, large metal ship that'll make it feel like the waves aren't there, and plumbing on your boat, and and he always wants to talk to the British Council.
That's right.
That's the funny part. So they make
it follow the guidance of the council.
Yeah, yeah. This 12-year-old boy like meeting with Parliament.
Yeah. So these three children then sort of make it into Narnia via a painting of the Don Treader hanging in the guest room at the Scrub household that sort of explodes into water. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they're floating and being fished out of the sea by Caspian and his crew. And they're in Narnia.
For less clear reasons than in Prince Caspian. So
I would say, now that I'm thinking about it, throughout the book, there's not a very clear reason as to why they're there.
No, in Prince Caspian, they've been called back. They are sort of they are the help that is magic is sending when the horn is blown. In Narnia, there's a prophecy about them and why they should be there in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. For this book, a reason is never stated except at the very end. At the very end, Aslan gives Edmund and Lucy a reason for all of their trips to Narnia, but not really clearly
this one.
Which
is very personal to Edmund and Lucy.
Yes.
Yeah. He brought them to Narnia so that they could learn about Aslan, so that they would seek to find more about Aslan in their own world.
Right.
Yeah. So if I were to chase down a singular sort of theological theme in here, I'm not sure you're going to like it, and I think I'm going to be accused of bringing my Lutheranism into Lewis. But I would say there's a very strong saint and sinners or semiostis epicator theme in this that even so, if you take the Eustace character, mm-hmm. like Adam described, he's a pain in the butt, like to the extreme. And he wanders off at one point, finds some dragon treasure. The dragon dies. He puts on some of the dragon treasure. And that night he becomes a dragon. And he's a dragon for a while until his dragon scales are first scratched off, first by he as a dragon.
Which you learn is essentially accomplishing nothing.
Accomplishes nothing. Every time he scratches, he never scratches deep enough.
Yeah.
And there's new dragon skin underneath. And so Aslan has to appear and literally tear off his dragon skin. Oh. And then he's baptized in a well.
I think that was very clearly the imagery.
And he comes out as Eustace. The first person he sees is Edmund. And he doesn't tell Edmund the story of how he became a dragon. He tells Edmund the story of how he went from being a dragon to becoming back to Eustace. But and this carries over into Silver Chair, honestly. Lewis very intentionally points out that that Eustace now is a believer in Aslan. He's all in. He's a Narnian, right? But he's still not a great person.
Yeah, he does even point that out, and that he has reversions back to being.
He has reversions, and they're often, you know, and you see them pop up, and you see him catch himself and correct himself. But it never stops, and it doesn't stop in Silver Chair. I mean, in Silver Chair, he holds a grudge against Jill Bowl the entire book. So,
I mean, also not to make the whole thing a little too Lutheran, but I mean, Lewis is a Protestant, so close-ish on some of the major points, right? It is clear that Eustace can't do it himself. Right? He cannot sort of undragon himself. And I also think there's an interesting sort of point about him not telling the story about how he became a dragon, but really being a dragon is actually him seeing himself for what he has been the whole time.
Yeah, he finally sees. So that's, if you're going to do law stuff, right? Yes. That's the mirror.
It's the mirror.
Yes.
Yeah.
The law has... him being a dragon has finally, and he sees himself as a dragon in the reflection.
The law has done its work on him, and he sees for himself for what he is.
Uh-huh. And it's only then, when he knows who he is as this sort of horrible monster who's been torturing everybody this whole time, holding grudges, jealous, all this, that any change can be made. Funny enough, still, is that the change isn't made from the inside.
So, well, isn't there, I'm not going to say it right, but there's even the mention by the narrator, I think, or by Edmund, and I don't remember exactly, but that Eustace was a much better person as a dragon than he ever was as a person.
Yeah, yeah, he became helpful and stuff, yeah. But that's not what stopped him from being a dragon anymore.
Yeah, no, he had to be undragoned.
Yeah, so there was no, like, once you realize you're a bad person, you can do something about it to stop being... the dragon,
yeah, right? Repent me, O Lord, and I will be repented.
Yeah, he gets a new mast for the ship. He supplies them with goats and pigs for food as this dragon who can hunt. He scouts ahead and finds another island. He does all sorts of helpful things.
And like many of us, his sinner in the saint sinner equation comes out when he gets an actual voice again.
Yeah,
and is able to use words.
Yeah, but the actual undragoning happens from the outside, happens from Aslan.
But I do think that's a very sort of, I think conversion is a very strong theme in here. Unlikely conversion, conversion is painful. You know, not an easy process.
Do you think, I wondered.
And then I think saint sinner. Like, don't expect the converted person you knew who was kind of a jerk before conversion
to be perfect.
To just be this nice, helpful, always happy dude after conversion. I don't expect that of Adam.
Do you think, I kind of wondered during some of the descriptions of Eustace after and while he was changing from the dragon, if Eustace is Lewis pre-conversion.
I think he is.
Yeah.
I think that's very... And I think Eustace is the main character in this. Mm-hmm. Caspian is a secondary, if not tertiary, character in this. As Edmund is almost not a character.
For a lot of the book.
For a lot of the book. Lucy, you know, being typically Lewis's favorite character, you finally see a falter in Lucy. A big falter, more so than in Prince Caspian, where she has to admit that she didn't follow Aslan initially, right? Mm-hmm. But more so here, when she enters the house of the magician and she's looking through the Book of Spells, and she actually partakes in a spell that she shouldn't have, where she basically gets to see what her friends say about her when she's not around, and it's not good stuff. And one of the things I love is that I don't remember the exact words, but she asks Aslan if she'll ever be able to forget the way they spoke about her. And he says, no. Mm. And I think that's very interesting, because if you think, you haven't been married long enough, perhaps, but for Adam and I, you know, you eventually, throughout your many years of marriage, we'll maybe get into a squabble, or since we're speaking of the Brits here, a row with your wife, and words might be said about you.
I only wish the listeners could see you talk to Caleb over the screen.
I mean,
your facial expressions are hilarious.
That you might want to forget, but you... Yeah. You perhaps can't forget them.
Yeah, that's funny.
And you have to sort of go on still living with and loving this person. And forgiveness and absolution can still happen and everything, but our sinful minds are such that Aslan's right, we likely will never forget what we heard. And I thought Lewis did a very good job of four children writing a story about a child, Lucy, who realizes that part of living with other people in this world and still loving them is going to be accepting the fact that you don't always like who they are, or that they're still sinners, and that they're maybe still your friend. So Aslan makes the point to her that she doesn't, I don't remember her friend's name, but she doesn't know what her friend was going through that made her talk to the older girl that way about Lucy, that she was scared that she was going to be ganged up on, that Lucy wasn't there for sort of backup, and that she didn't, you know, that she said what she said for her own reasons. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty good.
So I don't think you're reading Lutheran theology into this. I think that's what you get if you're reading the book and not reading other stuff into it. I think the terminology you use, like simul justus et peccator, is particularly Lutheran, but I think that's just you just describing what you find in the text. And like Caleb, you said something earlier. You said Lewis was a Protestant. I think Lewis is a classic Protestant. You know, Lewis is intentionally pre-modern in his worldview, and I think he's, I mean, again, I don't think you're reading things into the text. That's what you get out of it if you're reading it closely. In fact, what I see, in hunting around, looking at sort of like the I'm using air quotes here for a listener, the scholarship on this, interestingly, the interpretation of Eustace's better behavior afterwards is that that's what happens. You becoming a believer in Aslan, in the case of Eustace, will change your behavior, is sort of what I found just poking around a bit on the internet. But I think Lewis is, again, he's no Lutheran, doesn't need to be, but he is a reformational conservative Christian. And so it makes sense that you would find this in here, because that is reformational conservative Christianity.
Yeah, to know that what it's, in other words, it's a more modern concept of Christian conversion to say that it's a progressively upward thing from the point of conversion till you go to heaven, that it's going to be better and better every day. Yeah. That's a modern evangelical interpretation of the text.
Yeah.
A classically Protestant one would say, no, that line's going to be more like, I always say it's more like, well, it's kind of like this audio thing that I'm looking at here on your computer, Caleb.
Yeah.
But kind of like a heart monitor too, you know, where it's like up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. And that is the Christian life. I mean, it is classically reformational. It's also classically Pauline. It's very Romans 7. You don't have to read Luther to get this. You can read Romans and you will.
Yeah. And the grounds for
heck, you can read the Old Testament.
The better behavior is not some, I don't think the book indicates it's fear of turning back into a dragon if he backslides far enough. I don't think.
No, that's why I said he's an Arnian.
It's faith in Aslan, really.
Yes, he's a believer.
And that's why the journey becomes favorable now too, that the adventure exists because somebody like Aslan, as Aslan's country is now real.
Yeah.
Right, because Aslan is real for Eustace. And so the fact that they're journeying to the end of the known world towards Aslan's country no longer seems pointless. And so going on this journey now, you know, means he's not complaining about a journey that he's been, quote, kidnapped on anymore. He's no longer a captor.
He's now a member of the crew. British consulate.
And so, yeah, so the so the difference is not really behavior, but it's the difference between somebody who's a prisoner and somebody who's a member of the crew.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great way to say it. So I was going to say, Adam, as a comparison between the movie and the book, Reaper Cheap is a much more larger-than-life character in the movie than he is in the book.
Although I think he's still quite witty and fun in the book.
He is witty and fun in the book, but he's oftentimes seen as really annoying in the book, too. Whereas you don't see that in the movie. He's sort of just brave and courageous and always faithful in the movie. And they actually put in some times where he is brave and courageous and faithful in the book, but he's just... You know, even Caspian says, I shall have you bound and gagged if I could. You know?
He's almost a virtue signaler.
If it would not
in the book.
Beseech thy honor. What?
He's almost a virtue signaler in the book, you know, bestowing his noble virtue everywhere to everyone.
Right.
But yeah, in the movie, Reaper Cheap is outstanding. I mean, we still have about 5 minutes left, and I don't want to get too far ahead, in the movie, when they get to the end there, I still tear up. You know, when he goes
into Aslan's country.
Yeah.
It's actually the portrayal of it in the movie is a little more moving than in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like it's not so much of a big event.
No,
it's the culmination in the movie.
That Reaper Cheap did make it, but you know, nobody's seen him and nobody's heard back.
Yeah,
And that he's there in the book. He's there because a trade had to be made too. In order, somebody had to be left behind for them to return.
Yeah, and that doesn't, that trade. Now,
and Reaper Cheap's like, me.
But in this case, Reaper Cheap is really the one who does make Caspian return.
Yes.
He had sort of been swept up by the magic of the end of the world. And this actually was vocational. That he was going to abandon his calling
to be king of Narnia.
And everybody who he serves as king, everybody who's under him, he was going to abandon all of that to go on this. And a lot of people are objecting, and Reaper Cheap is the one who points out that it would be an abandonment of his vocation and all those left in Narnia.
And the vocation is about care for those people that God has placed in your life under your care.
And then Edmund, actually, this is the pivotal role that Edmund ends up playing in the book, which is that he is the only one who isn't under Caspian's authority. So all these people could hurl this at Caspian, and he could still, as king, demand that they bow to his wish here to essentially, you know, defect from his own kingdom. But Edmund, being an ancient king above Caspian, you know, is able to say, you might be able to silence everyone, but I forbid it.
Yeah.
And my word comes from the high king, Peter, which is also interesting. So the authority gets sort of tossed back. And he very unhappily goes to the ship where Aslan has a word with him about his vocation.
Well, he goes and sulks in his room.
Yeah.
And Aslan appears to him.
Yeah.
And has words. Be like, sorry, guys, I talked to Aslan.
Also, you do get the sense that Caspian's a teenage boy in this. So it was Alistair McGrath in one of the podcasts talks about how it's been said in some of the academic literature about Lewis that he's a bad namer. He has a hard time naming things, that a lot of the names he makes up don't make any sense. He's got a couple good ones, but really he's not too good at this. And I think his poor naming conventions really come out in the teenage boy Caspian, who just names whatever island, whatever adjective best suits it. He doesn't actually give them names.
That's Death Island over there.
Yeah, that's that's the island with goats on it. And you're like, this is obviously a 16-year-old naming these. And then the only positive thing that makes him want to get back on the boat is the idea of marrying this girl.
Ramandu's daughter.
Yes. They say that, and he's like, well, maybe I should go back.
She was quite beautiful.
Yeah. You're just like, he does a pretty good job of showing Caspian is a young king yet.
He does marry her, by the way.
Yeah. So, but no, overall, pretty good. And then we've got 1 minute left, so we can get to the very end, which is, you know, like we were saying, there are tidbits of theological points here. Not one as on the nose as in some of the other books, so to say. Until Aslan comes in at the end and Lucy and Edmund are sort of pleading with Aslan about their next return to Narnia, because at this point now there's a pattern for them. And Aslan just very bluntly tells them they will not be coming back to Narnia again, and that Narnia was for the sake of them finding Aslan in their own
land. And now they have to go home and find him in their own land.
And it is...
By another name. Yeah,
by another name.
It's an interesting message, I think, maybe to even the readers about... To the children reading books, this book, what Narnia is to be in their imagination, which is a reason to go find Aslan by his true name in our world.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to end it.
I felt like that was sort of the synopsis of what the series is to the people who enter Narnia via the text.
Right.
Which was, it's not really for its own, it's not for you to exist in and live in. It's not for you to dwell on excessively. It is to make you thirst for finding this in your world.
When you find out in the silver chair that that's likely the reason that Eustace and Jill are brought in too, because they don't know the name of Jesus in their own land
at all. At yeah. all.
They don't know, cause they go to school in Cambridge.
Do you think Lewis added that, put it in there because of that? That he, is he doing that? He's got to be doing it out of fun, because what is it?
He ends
about
up
2 years afterwards. He ends up in Cambridge, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
He's an Oxford guy.
It's a teasing, right? Yeah, to call Cambridge like the progressive modernist thing. Yeah. I mean, now all of England is so. It's
but. The digs at school never stop with Lewis. Lewis did not like school. He did not at least like the English public school system at all. And the digs never stop. Like, they just never stop.
And that is interesting. The Pevensies are obviously privately tutored, and their cousins are not.
Yeah. I mean, basically, Peter is off doing what Lewis did with the Great Knock. And this is the only thing that's valuable. And anybody else who's described as going to school, even when they're in the train station in Prince Caspian, or even as they're waiting at Eustace's house, they're sort of in the break term from boarding school, which they hate.
Yeah.
They can't stand it. So Lewis's digs at school never stop. In this, and then his sort of he has several, I think, digs at Cambridge that are more fun, but you also get the school that I don't know, this is maybe me going too far, but the school that we should maybe save it for next week too, but that Eustace and Jill go to is obviously the school where they use the green book from
The Abolition of Man.
Abolition of Man.
Yeah.
It's like so obvious.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, I know we're a little over time, but at the very end, when they get back to our world, everybody remarks how Eustace is a different person. You never know him for the same boy, right? But then the parents, or is it
his parents?
I've got my notes here.
His mom, I think.
Thinks of Eustace as being very commonplace and tiresome now.
Yeah.
Is that the mom's modernist arrogance against her boy who now has a bigger worldview, if you will?
Yeah, she attributes it to the time he spent with the Pevensey children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's the fact that he's got an imagination now.
Yeah.
He's probably, you can now see that he went from like reading textbooks in his spare time to playing.
Yeah, or reading fairy tales.
Yeah. And now that he imagines and he plays after his cousins were there for a break, he's now commonplace. Yeah. He's like other children.
So when reading this, what I was thinking, it's sort of like, I don't want to name names here just in case they listen. But when my kid, my homeschool kids.
Intriguing.
Oh, his kids.
My homeschool kids would go and play with, say, their cousins who are schooled in public schools, government schools, the play is very different. When my kids are playing, it's just play. It's screeching and hide and go seek and running around woods, and it's a free for all.
When Caleb's kids are playing,
it's
loud.
Making up stories.
It's a lot
of telling Emerson which character he is.
He does it back.
I have heard him do it back lately.
It's like a fantasy world. But then when they're playing with cousins, I'm just making that up, of course. But cousins that are go to government schools, it's tattletaling and correcting other people and virtue signaling. It's insane. But anyway, reading this last time, actually I read this bit just a couple hours ago as I finished up the book. I was thinking, this is sort of like what you see now when homeschool kids are around state school kids.
That makes sense.
No offense to those whose children go to state schools.
And just for the record, two of my kids go to state schools now, public schools.
Which two?
The older two, Tim and Kiana, she's in high school now. Yeah, so she's learned.
I didn't know it was going to be a trend. I just thought it was because Tim wanted to.
Well, yeah. I mean, Kiana's not sold on it yet, but she's makes fun of a lot of the stuff. You know how everybody has to use their pronouns when they introduce themselves and so on.
But, oh boy,
lordy,
yeah.
Lord.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Yeah, we should probably stop before I.
And on that note, I'm gonna go home and homeschool my kids.
Yeah, we should probably stop.
Well, guys, very fun. We did it. No challenge at all, getting to the end of the episode.
Personally, it was before we did this kind of one of my favorites, and now rereading Silver Chair and Horse and His Boy. I don't know. I like Silver Chair a lot.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. This one was fun for. I thought this was fun.
I agree.
Out of all,
very adventurous.
The island hopping, the different stories that happen on every island. It reminded me of, the Odyssey. It reminded me the seafaring disaster reminded me of other nautical tales. So I thought it was fun for that regard as well. So. But it'll be interesting to continue on. That means next week for us is the Silver Chair, right?
Absolutely.
Yep. So that is
70 years after this.
Yeah. So if you're reading along with us, that is the direction we are going. We hope you enjoyed this episode and this whole series. If you would like to support the Thinking Fellows and 1517, you can go to 1517.org/donate. And we greatly appreciate your support for continuing the efforts of 1517 and podcasts like this. Thank you. We will catch you next week. Bye.